Well, we might as well hit it. You guys have asked. Again, we delivered. You guys can thank Francis and Constantine and the amazing guys over at Trigonometry for this one. Welcome to the show, Mike Baker. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, I'm honored to be here.
That's a shock.
I know. Well, it is a shock. It's a shock to me too. Not only did I not mean it, but no, I am kidding. I'm very happy to be here.
Wow, as one in the CIA always does, they never stop, do they? They just nope, they just spit out the truth just like that. Well, we might as well start off with that. Since you're not really that honored to be here, we can lean in. Hey, Mike, why the CIA?
No, I think we've gotten off to a really good start.
It's great.
Why the CIA?
Yeah, seriously.
That's a good question. I hadn't gone searching for them. I hadn't intended to or hadn't planned on it necessarily. Circumstances and a series of events led to an introduction, and then as they're wont to do, a lot want to do as they tend to do, a lot of interviews, a lot of discussions. There's a whole process involved, even back then, and probably even more so back then. And so ended up being recruited and into the operations group, and I had a great time. I'm not one of those people that didn't get enough hugs. Every now and then you get someone coming out of an organization and they bitch and moan about it, or they complain, or they think if only I'd been listened to, we wouldn't have had this disaster or something. And that's bullshit. I had a great time, met some wonderful people, still know some fantastic people there. So I think it's always good. That's sort of my caveat is, if people think, I'm not a shill for the agency, but I had a great time. And so that colors my perspective because I saw some amazing things and some people do some incredible things. Never for a pat on the back, and certainly not for the money. So yeah, it was a good ride. It was a really good ride.
I love that you say it's a good ride because a lot of my other friends that are ex-CIA, I don't know that you ever get out, Mike.
Oh, sure you do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, anybody who kind of winks and says, "Oh, of course you're." Now, once it's like any other, thing. Once you decide to step out for whatever your reason, then yeah, it's not a you don't have these two-way conversations. I never call them up and ask them for inside information or any details, even though I run an intelligence and security services firm.
Right.
It's not like I would ever call them up and think that they're going to tell me something secret. You don't put them on the spot like that, right? You sign a paper that says you keep your yap shut until you die. And you also understand that you don't get to dip back in, right? It's a little bit different. It's not like a law enforcement's a little bit different, right? Law enforcement's sort of the old boy network, and maybe you were with the Bureau, the Secret Service, or NYPD, whatever it is. There tends to be more of an ability to go back as an old boy network and, have two-way dialogue, that sort of thing. But that's not how the agency works or should work.
Well, this is true. Unfortunately, I do notice that there are or have been a series of events that have happened over the past, I don't know, couple of years, 3, 4 years. What do we, when was 21? 3 years ago? 3 years ago? Where it seems like individuals that were ex-CIA seem to dip a toe back into areas of the countries that we were involved in for 20 years and start doing some dicey things. And I can say those people that are willing to cross lines, I do appreciate in that time and place. That being said, I know that not everybody does have that relationship, but it's been really fascinating to find out about you, kind of as I would assume, and I'm sure you're not, I'm sure you're used to this being said. Most people, I believe, found out about you through Joe and through that show and through those platforms and really saw a very different side of what it means to be an operator, transition out, and then take it into a completely different area of expertise. I just never thought I would see somebody who had such in-depth experience over such a very important time in history switch to TV, Mike.
Well, neither did I. Okay. That was a new one on me too. But what I tell you, what happened was a couple of events. Okay. I'm bored people with all these.
No, I want to give it all.
All right, I'm just gonna throw it all out there. Once I'd gotten out of the outfit and had started a business with a dear friend of mine who came out of the British teams, and so we were based in London, just trying to start to build a business, right? Intelligence, global security, information services, risk mitigation. We had no business experience, didn't know what the hell we were doing, right? But we were having a great time. And so at that very early time, a friend of ours, who was already successful showrunner in the UK, called up, and he's a great guy, David Wollstonecraft, a terrific guy, a terrific writer. And so he was in between projects and he was trying to figure out what to do next. And so we all got together for drinks and we had more drinks and then we drank more. And out of all of that, David put together a terrific show that in the UK was called Spooks. And then migrated over here where it was labeled MI5 and did very well, ran for whatever, 8 seasons on BBC. And so that sort of opened a door in a sense to TV work. And then the other thing that happened was we started to build our business a little bit. We opened an office in Washington, D.C. And one day our investors, one of them came in and said, hey, who was it? What outlet? It was Fox News. Was looking for somebody. It was, I think, March of 2003. We had just gone into Iraq. And, you know, our company had already had some people on the ground there, doing some stuff.
I just love watching you. Okay, I'm sorry. If you guys aren't watching this, you just watched his brain go, no, I can't say that. No, I can't say that. No, I can't say that. Doing some work.
Doing some stuff. Yeah, softening the target. And so anyway, one of the investors, a great guy, came running in and said, they need somebody to talk about Iraq. I had a quick conversation with my old folks saying, you know, is that something I can do? I have no idea. And they said, yeah, don't say anything stupid, you know, and obviously, you know, no sources and methods or anything like that. But yeah, by all means, go. So we had some people there. So we had a kind of a sense of what was happening on the ground. And so what I realized, which I hadn't been smart enough to understand before, was all I had to do was show up on the network and they would put who I was, right? So they would say, Mike Baker, and then they put the name of the company. And we had only been in business for a relatively short period of time. And so that was, in that, once I realized that and realized the value of it, then you couldn't keep me off the air. So now I was like a talking head whore. That was the other side of it. So I started doing a lot of the news, and then I was also getting more involved in the entertainment side of it as well. So,
right.
So that's kind of where we ended up.
It's interesting to see the transition. The reason I say that and the reason I bring it up is because you've got this dynamic shift happening, you know, post-Afghan, post-Iraq, post this GWAT. I say Afghan and Iraq just because I know Canadians and Brits don't really necessarily resonate with GWAT, so bear with me. But I will say we are seeing this rise of what we call the intelligence veteran celebrity kind of triangle of death that is these talking heads that normally would get your ass PNG'd. So I'm trying to figure out how somebody with a stature like yourself in a time frame where we were looking for people we couldn't find to go onto a television and start necessarily just, you know, having a dialogue that seems so foreign. Yeah. I mean, the idea of a CIA member going out any other time prior to that, you're not allowed back on a base. You're losing security clearance. You're no longer allowed at funerals. Like, that's a real reality.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yes and no. It depends on, I mean, it wasn't common. I'll tell you that much. It wasn't, you know, that's why I was like very cautious at the very beginning of that first Iraq incursion as to whether it was even kosher to do it or not. And so they were very clear. And said, yeah, by all means, in part because they had been very good to me when I decided it was time to leave. You know, I was just going to leave. And, you know, they were like, okay, well, what are you going to say you didn't? I said, I don't know. You know, it's like I import export, or I was selling rugs or something. And
right.
So they said, no, we should come up with a way that you can say where you worked, you know, without. So they opened that door, and they didn't have to do that, but they were very good about saying you should be able to leave in a somewhat overt fashion without going into gruesome detail about what it was you were doing on our behalf. And that wasn't all that common. So mm-hmm. I give them a lot of credit, and I'm very appreciative, because that certainly helped develop my business. Obviously it gave me more, you know, if I had to go out and say, yeah, I was worked at the Department of Commerce, or I was at the Secretary, you know, I was at the Department of Labor or something, you know, that's how I explained that, you know, almost 20-year gap in my resume, then it might not have helped in terms of building a intelligence and security services firm down the road. So I was very appreciative of the fact that they did that. But you're right, then it's much more common now, right? Mm-hmm. So it's much more common to see people that get out there. I mean, shit, directors, former directors have written books. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people have written books about it. And, you know, the only time I get a little aggrieved or irritated is when we'll get somebody who comes out after like maybe one tour. Maybe they didn't even do a tour. Maybe they just went through training. Maybe they did one 2-year tour, and then they leave and they write a book about my life at the agency. I'm thinking, really, really, how was that life at the agency? But, you know, that's about the only time. Everything else, as long as people aren't disclosing things that they shouldn't,
right?
Then I think the agency understands they needed to be a change. They needed to be a little bit more transparent. They needed to be, you know, get a little bit of more light on the organization. Because times are changing, and, you know, they need to still attract and try to recruit, you know, the right people. And
brought to you by Mindful Meds. You guys have been seeing me take Mindful Meds for a little while now. Mindful Meds is a premium supplement company dedicated to supplying humans with the tools to improve their mental health, clarity, and performance, all while supporting their growth along the way. Whether it's the Immunity Blend, Lion's Mane, Inspire, or Voyage, all of their products are clean, tested, consistent, and they've become a huge help in my life. I found Mindful Meds over a year ago now, and I've never looked back. Go check out their website, mindfulmeds.io, and use the code BRASS at checkout.
You know, so to do that, they can't just be this cloak and dagger organization that you know nothing about, right? And, so I think some of that openness has probably helped from a recruitment potential.
Yeah, I mean, so overt, it's covert. It's a brilliant way to do things. If you give a little, you're going to get a lot more in return.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so that's why they've got a Twitter page. Is it Twitter? No, it's X. They've got an X page.
It's X now, right? We can't.
Yeah.
Not, I'm sorry. Can we just for a second? I don't X. I don't X. I tweet.
I know. I sent you an X. What? I mean, yeah, it doesn't work as well. Doesn't work as well. I know I've stumbled over that one as well myself, but they've got one, they've got a page there or a site. And you know, their recruitment process is a little bit more open. It didn't used to be that way, but I can see why they need to adjust to some degree.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, it's like, come apply, not tap you on the shoulder while you're walking to school somewhere. Right. Hey, take this phone number.
Although that we still get some of our best recruits, you know, and you'd be surprised. It's like toddlers. You know, no, it's
hey, listen, y'all, you guys are no different than the service members. Let's be honest with ourselves. We all go into these practices, these positions, these jobs for a reason. We're a type of person, and that's just the harsh reality. So they know who you are, and they know what they're looking for. And if you haven't applied, they'll make you apply. They think that they want you.
They'll make you apply.
They'll subtly position your entire life to fall apart in your dream job so that when they tap you on the shoulder, it's like, oh my God, timing is everything, Mike.
Yeah, wow, this works out very well.
Wow, transition like nothing. So let's talk about the transition. God, that word's weird to use around you because I'm not using it in the way it's being used, but we're going to use it. So transition for you was
yeah, this
much...
is going to shock all the neighbors, won't it? Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, Mike, if you were the one guy who came out the next time you went on Rogan, it was like, listen, I'm going as Michelle now.
I got something to talk about.
But you don't change your voice though in any way, shape or form.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't know. I, you know, God bless anybody who wants to do whatever the hell they want to. You know, and I always say the same thing, which is I don't give a shit what anybody wants. I really don't care. You know, I don't need to celebrate it. They don't need to celebrate me. Nobody needs to celebrate me. No, I don't need to celebrate you. Just get on with it. As long as you're not hurting anybody, God bless, and I hope you're happy. Who cares? Life is too short.
Can you imagine if that was the actual rhetoric we lived around, which is who cares? Move on, live your life.
Yeah, yeah. It would be pretty simple, right? I mean, anyway.
Yeah, but we got to create our own problems to have a reason to fight, don't we? Sorry, that's just me. I digress. Back to transition.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Well, if you listen to the episode that was released on trigonometry yesterday, you will see I have some minor good points.
So that's what they said when they first sent me a note. You know, they said, yeah, we believe that she occasionally. Okay.
Occasionally. I think
Yeah.
Yeah. One out of 10. It's one out of 10. We do the best we can. Listen, we all try. Let's talk.
Yeah.
This is too good. So I want to, the reason I bring up the transition point for you and why you're able to do it is so many of the listeners around the world are in this sticky transition point from a combat arms role, a intelligence role, a policing role. And they're going into this, the civilian world where anybody can be whatever they want to be and do whatever they want to do. And we come from very different spaces. And to step into those worlds, you did transition really successfully over. And it sounds like it was due to having a whole host of options at your disposal, meaning you had permissions, you weren't PNG'd, you kind of did it right. And then you transitioned to a new area. And like you said, it ended up uplifting your business. So I'm just trying to always ask people when they're going from something as heavy hitting as the CIA to their own intelligence world, how that was able to be mitigated in terms of, I mean, you have a family, you've spoken about it before, so I'm not going to go too deep into it because I try to respect people's private lives, even though you have pictures of your children behind you. I try to be, is that your daughter with the baseball?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, that's my main man.
Oh,
yeah,
that's your guy up there?
That's my son, Jason. Yeah.
I'm talking about the girl to the bottom left of you.
Yes.
Yeah, see, I catch things. Listen, we're not all CIA, but we're paying attention here, Mike. But I'm trying to figure it out to give people the right answers, because you did have a family, you did have children, you came from a world that was very different, and you did transition into something that opened you up to criticism, opened your family up to potential security concerns. And I'm just trying to understand how somebody transitions successfully and still is able to, you know, find themselves within that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, at the time, I had a daughter, a very young daughter, who, I mean, she wasn't, you know, how old was she? She was, I guess, 10 or so. And so I needed to find a way to stay home more because I was, at that point, I was a single dad. And so I needed to be home because that was important. It seemed to me that was important.
I mean, life is important to look after.
That might be important if I'm taking care of my daughter. And she didn't give a shit what I was doing, right? She didn't care that what I was doing was cool. She wanted me home. You know, I'll sit on the floor playing with Legos. And so that was my reason for...
Hey, humans. I know you've all been seeing me drink HVMN's Ketone IQ lately. This is a game changer. Jet fuel in a bottle. I use Ketone IQ for everything in my life, whether it's running, cycling, podcasting, or just the extra boost that my brain needs. I won't lie, it helps push me to the next level in all things. I love Ketone IQ and what HVMN stands for. Go grab some shots today at HVMN.com and use the code BRASS20 and save.
Transitioning. I had to find something that would keep me from being out on the road all the time. And so... I think for me, the biggest, most important step was just leaping into it. Right, I had no idea what we were going to do. I had this close friend of mine. We had an idea because he was getting out at the same time, and we had an idea. Well, whatever we were going to do, let's team up because you know we get along great. And be a lot of laughs, but we didn't really know what the hell we were doing. We didn't have any money. I can assure you of that. And, we had no credit, you know, we couldn't, between he and I, we couldn't even get cell phones, and we were in London. And so, but what we did do was didn't do it half-assed. We didn't keep one foot in our previous world and one foot in the new world. And you'll get that a lot of times with transition. I talk to a lot of guys who, okay, I'm going to take a contract, right? So I'm going to kind of, I'm going to stay with what I know, but I want to do this other thing. And at least for me anyway, I think what led us to actually having some luck was we had no other option, right? We just, we just jumped in. We didn't have a clue how we were going to put food on the tables. And so when you do that, and when you commit 100% to whatever it is that you're going to do next, there's no plan B, right? You got to make that work. And so that for us, and I'm sure some people will listen to that from a business perspective and go, that's stupid. You should always have a plan B.
Not stupid if it doesn't work.
Yeah. It's always stupid if it doesn't work. And you know, so yeah, we got, and also the agency, you know, and my buddy's, operational unit, he was with SBS. They teach you certain things, right? And they teach you to just get on with it. They teach you to, you know, basically make decisions with imperfect information. They teach you how to just, you know, get off the X and make a decision, which is important. And some people just sit around and wait for all the data to come in, and eventually something bad's going to happen. So I think that was the biggest, if I had to point to one defining factor, that was the biggest thing, was we just had no other option. And so we had to get out. I've talked to a lot of guys who are looking to get out. They're looking to do that transition. And the other, one other part here is they undervalue their experience, right? And they don't understand how that works. And they don't understand, you know, everything they've learned, they have a hard time imagining how that benefits a company or a corporation.
Immensely,
yeah. And so they've got to get over that. They've got to understand that what they've learned, and it's a two-way thing. Companies and corporations need to understand the value of bringing in people from that world, right? But the individual needs to have more confidence in all those things that they've picked up that they may not even realize they've learned, right? They can apply or be adapted to a commercial setting. So you spend some time talking with them and trying to explain, look, no, understand what it is that, and how you package that up and present it, right? It's obviously different than how you would do it if you were in the military or wherever. But so I think there's certain elements that can help ease the transition. But it is a big, it's a big step. If I hear one thing more than anything, it's the difficulty in moving on, right? Plus also you're dealing with the emotional side of it, right? You've got that camaraderie, and you've got, and depending on what kind of team operations you were in, and that's tough to replicate, right? It's damn near impossible, but you've got to find, we've been lucky. I've been lucky. And, I found all sorts of new challenges, right? They're not the same challenges, but so I think you have to, I know a lot of guys that I worked with that when we get together, or, there's a lot of talk about the old days, right? I had a great time, but I don't necessarily need to rehash the old days all the time, right? I'd rather talk about some things happening now or shit that we're going to do later. And so anyway.
Yeah, it's about looking forward. And I appreciate your perspective on that. And the reason I pry at it, and I'm sure you've been asked this stuff before, but I think it's important to illustrate the importance of getting off the X and taking that risk and jumping in with two fucking feet, because part of the problem we see in this community, and we got the 44 a day. These numbers are not, they're not pretend. There's a reason why the statistic is constantly growing. There is something missing. We're missing the mark here. And it's not like we're adjusting after you drop around. We just keep dropping and expecting a different result, which is quite literally ridiculous. So when I talk to anybody that has had such a successful transition from a very intense position, it's really important to try to gather data, because people are listening to this are going to go, well, if this guy can get out after such a, prolific career in the CIA and move into an area that's maybe adjacent or linear to, but is ultimately stepped all the way over, because you get that, that dynamic that happens where it's one foot in, one foot out. And like you said, when you're doing that, you're constantly going to be pulling backwards, and you're meeting with friends and you're drinking and talking about the past. And so when you're ruminating on these experiences, it's of course important to acknowledge, because unlike the rest of the service, you know, the CIA, they don't talk about when people are lost. We don't say names. There's reasons why they're stars, and that's it. But when you get those opportunities to embrace those moments and discuss those people, I understand the importance of keeping the names alive. That being said, if it's constantly holding you back in a position where it is not allowing you to then fulfill what is ultimately the future of where you're going, not where you've been, this is where I believe the lack of purpose, lack of direction, and the lack of seeing people do it really successfully happens. And then it's that, you know, pattern of behavior.
Yeah, I think there's a concern, like someone's getting out. There's this feeling like, okay, I need a safety net. Now, particularly, yeah, of course, if you got a partner, you got kids, whatever, then of course that's a factor, right? You gotta worry about that sort of thing. But I'm just saying that if you kind of half-ass it, right? If you got one foot in and one foot out, you're not gonna realize your potential really on either side, right? And so it can be painful, and it can be a little frightening. But you know, for what it's worth, I mean, that's always my advice: is look, don't do that. Don't. And I know a lot of guys, and they want to do the contracting overseas, and you know, because the daily rate looks good and okay, but you know, that doesn't give you the opportunity to pursue, you know, whatever that new challenge is full time, because you're deploying, you know, 4 or 6 weeks or whatever, and you come back and now you're still thinking about deploying. And so I used to actually discourage guys, and we had during the height of the whole mess out in Iraq, we had maybe 400 people out there. But I used to discourage people from doing it, because I said, look, if your focus is on the future,
right,
you know, this is a grind, right? This is not going to get you there quicker. Mm-hmm. It may feel safer. You may like the money in the short term, but you know, think about it in a different way. You know, get a longer view, perhaps.
It's comfortable.
Yeah. And I realize people can listen to me say things like that and go, well, you're a douchebag. You got lucky and you did it, so it's easy for you. It's like when somebody's wealthy and somebody's saying, I don't mind paying more taxes. Well, you already got $2 fucking billion. And now, of course, you don't mind paying more taxes, you know. But so I get why people might go, okay, well, you're a bit of a douche.
No, you're not a douche. And I'll tell you why. I'd be like, Mike, you're a douche for saying that. You're not. The reason you're not is because you did exactly what you just verbalized, where you said, I did not keep one foot in the other, and I actually just took the fucking risk. I got off the X. The reason you're successful today is because you got off the X. It's not because you kind of danced in both worlds. It's because you did exactly what you are advising others to do. That is called lived experience. And that's why you're not a douche. Now, you'd be a douche.
Well, I could be.
Yeah. Well, you could be. Would be if you did the opposite of what you said.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah. So yeah, I get what you, yeah, yeah, that's all right. I take it back. I am not a douche. You know what? I'm actually quite a quality person. Yeah,
I think you're a good guy. And also, again, back to the good point.
Well, let's just end on that note then. What a fine gentleman he is.
What a great gentleman this Mike Baker is. No, I have too many questions for you to end on that. I'm so sorry. I apologize. But no, I have a lot for you. Okay. So I appreciate your perspective on that. And I think that it's incredibly noble to be able to look back, you know, and plot lines, but ultimately you did exactly what you said you would do. You took the risk and you didn't have a fallback, and it was successful because you went 100% in. So it's a good example, not a douchebag move. That being said, going to the TV side of things is a huge undertaking. But let's talk a little bit more about not only the TV side, because I've seen Black Files Declassified on Discovery and the Science Channel, and I do really appreciate it. I do appreciate the authenticity you bring to TV. I don't know how you go about not cursing on that while you're doing it.
No. One of the guys behind the camera, they hired a guy on the set that all he does is hold a big sign up saying, don't swear, and just follows me around everywhere. So that's how I remember. No, there's a lot of, if you saw some of the cut footage that never makes it to the show, there's a lot of profanity.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I don't know why people have such an issue with sounds out of the mouths. I've been told that I do that too much, but I think that there's a time and place for it and it's valued. And if it's a member of the CIA, I feel like it's baked into their genetics and everyone should get over themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, I couldn't have said it better.
Yeah, well, again, back to these good points that I make.
Yeah.
I want to understand how you jump from, you know, declassified to the presidential daily brief. I know there was a gap in there and you started doing podcasting, but like you really started to, and I mean this in like the kindest, loving, motherly energy I can put through this screen right now, because you didn't want to fly to Vancouver, which was, you're not the guy I would have thought that was like, yep, let's just put myself out there. Let's jump into the podcast world. Let's just dive into the uncomfortable things. Was it the whiskey draw?
Yeah.
Sitting and drinking? Yeah.
It was the free whiskey. That's what it was.
I knew it.
Said, I don't get paid for it. They just send me crates of booze. And I get liquored up and I do another episode. It was actually pretty straightforward because we were contracted to do a third season for Black Files Declassified.
Mm-hmm.
And then the network merged with Warner Brothers. And as always happens in TV land, when you have a merger of any sort, the first thing that the new people in charge want to do is fire all the old people. So they shit canned all the really high quality production folks, including, you know, our team that was advocating and doing our show. So they called and said, we're going to put it on ice for the time being, which in TV terms means it's never, ever going to see the light of day again. And so we set that aside. We're working on a couple other series, but then I forget when it was, but it was, we started the PDB. We started the President's Daily Brief in September of last year, 2023. Mm-hmm. But it was sometime shortly before then when I got a call from the folks that do the PDB and a variety of other shows and podcasts. And they said, would you be interested in hosting this? And, I'm not an idiot. I've been on podcasts before. I've seen the extent of Joe's, you know, operations, which are really interesting and unique.
Say I have.
Yeah. So. He's, so I knew the world to some degree. And I also knew that this, you know, was going to be backed up by a really good supporting group of people who know what they're doing, right? So the producers, the people who are invested in it, the writers and researchers. It was something that I thought, and also because I'd been, you know, opening my yap for a long time saying that, you know, too much of news is opinionated, right? And there's nobody in the center. There's nobody who's just trying to the degree possible, just give you the facts. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, you know, this could be a good chance. So it's, I won't say that it doesn't have a you know, my bias in there every now and then, or that I don't throw some, you know, some context in there. But for the most part, we just try to say what's happening with the top three or four stories of the day. And then move on. And we don't have any choice because it's only 20 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the afternoon. So you can't bang on and be too opinionated in a time like that. And I don't think anybody needs to hear more opinion necessarily. So while occasionally I might throw out a comment and people go, that's interesting. Most of the time I'm just literally trying to stick to the facts of the particular issue.
Right.
So that's kind of how it happened. I it wasn't a tough decision because it was, you know, it's a real quality group of people, First TV, and, you know, they're backed by an operation called Red Seat Ventures. And so it was really good operation. So that made it a lot easier. If somebody called up and said, Mike, you want to do it all by yourself and from scratch, then that's a different ball game. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it would have been fine either way. I do appreciate the length of the episodes. You can crush a few of them in a row. It does affect your psyche after, and you go, all right, that's a lot for today. But it's interesting to hear how you switch from topic to topic. And I do appreciate that you do put your, because it is, how do I describe this? When you listen to it, it is very much, you can tell that you are reverberating data points, But then you hear the, what I call like the Mike Baker little clip snips there at the end that are just kind of smacked in the middle. And that's your authenticity coming through, where you're like, you're giving those, not opinions, but you're kind of like, yeah, that's accurate, right?
Yeah, like that's you just bullshit. Kind of drop it. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like bullshit from the UN.
Right?
Yeah, it is. It is. I do firmly believe, even though, like I said, occasionally I'll throw a little something in there, but I do firmly believe that the problem we've got nowadays is that everything is so siloed, and the right. news that we receive is so opinionated, right? That people don't know where to go just for some news, right? The old news. So you used to be able to turn on CNN. CNN, in its early days, was fantastic operation. They had field bureaus all over the world. Something happened, they just tell you what was happening, right? It wasn't, because they weren't trying to, you know, play beat the clock against Fox News. And when Fox News started to have a lot of success on the right, that pushed all the other news outlets hard left, because they're trying to, you know, they're trying to figure out what's our differentiator. So then you end up with that, and people are all standing around going, well, where do I just get some news? And it can be tough. So we're trying to do that with the PDB to the degree possible.
So then you're recording every day, because these are real time events constantly changing. How is that, how's that been adapting to your already having an intelligence company schedule?
Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting because, you have to really worry about the upload times. And so the morning, we do, late night, the night before, and so we try to make sure that we're not missing out on it. Now, we may get screwed, right? Because overnight there may be some massive development. The next morning, you know, we've already uploaded the show and people are going, well, you know, how come the idiot missed, you know, this new development? So, and then we do the afternoon. Again, we kind of lag and we wait and wait and wait as long as possible to do the afternoon. So we capture as much as we can in terms of developments. So it is interesting, but look, I've been lucky with the business. And so Portman Square Group, for all your information and security needs, it kind of runs, not without me, but you know, sometimes I seem a little superfluous. And so I've been lucky that way, in that there's a lot of great people, you know, keeping those trains running on time. That allows me to, but it doesn't take too much time. You know, the draft scripts arrive, we have a chance to review them and edit them. And so we've kind of gotten into a good routine. We're going to turn this into a YouTube channel in your future. Yeah. And then we're going to start doing, bi-weekly or bi-monthly. I forget. An interview version of it. So it's a longer version, and then still keeping the PDB, you know, morning and afternoon thing going. So it's been great so far.
I think it's a great show, man. And I mean, it's number one for a reason.
Yeah. It's been fun. It really has been fun. It's been, and I'll tell you the other thing about it is it's easy because it's just interesting shit, right? And in the sense that, you know, I'm not talking about something I'm not interested in. I'm talking about foreign policy and national issues and crises and domestic concerns and other things. So at least it's interesting shit. If I was talking about something that I don't have any background in or don't really care about, then I think it would be a grind. Mm-hmm. But I think it's interesting. And we get to cover shit that other people don't necessarily talk about or they don't hear about.
Or want to.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's, you know, something's happening in wherever, Venezuela or the farmer protests in Europe or whatever it may be. You get to highlight other developments. Now, the world seems a little fucked up right now. So you're right. You can listen to one or two episodes and think, God, you know, what the hell's wrong here? You know, Putin's threatening to use nukes and, you know, Macron's threatening to put, you know, NATO troops on the ground in Ukraine. And
I have so many questions.
Kim Jong-un blasting another missile and, you know, God.
Oh, Michael, I have so many questions for you. All right. Well, since you just dove into it, I mean, feels like a normal transition here. So we might as well. Here's the difference between maybe a lot of shows that just ask you about you. I want to talk about a few of these issues. Like with the PBR, it's great and everything like that. But I want to pull a few things apart. And kind of prepping for this episode, I was thinking to myself, you know, what world issues are we going to talk about? And then I listed 30. And part of the problem with that is because there's so much going on that so many people, like you said, the media won't discuss. Sure, shit, in Canada, CBC isn't. We know why. And I want to understand a lot a lot more about some of these things. And I know we have limited time, but I want to crack on a few of these because you're not hearing about them on a lot of podcasts, unless it's like Lex or Joe or Trig. And I think there is a difference with some of those people versus what this show can bring. And the difference is really simply, like, this stuff doesn't have to be overcomplicated. And a lot of our listeners are coming from this world. So let's just start with any topic. I'm going to go with France because I'm a little blown away by the verbiage that was said out loud by this individual who pledged actual boots on the ground in a nation who strategically and very obviously on Tucker Carlson's last interview stated, like, we have come to the table, we're trying, they're not trying. And now we're saying an escalation of force while not clearing it with everyone else. Does that not feel like an escalation of World War III level shit here, Mike?
Yeah, it's a very odd comment. I mean, for those people that hadn't been following, you know, Emmanuel Macron said, you know, essentially that you have to leave everything on the table. You can't rule out putting NATO troops on the ground in Ukraine to help Ukraine defeat Russia. And, you know, they're almost within...
Your face says everything.
Yeah, within 30 seconds, yeah. I mean, everybody was jumping in there. Olaf Scholz from Germany and the Spanish, the Italians, the U.S., everybody was backpedaling, saying, whoa, you know, what the hell? And so Macron, I mean, he then doubled down later on. You know, he didn't back off of it. I think he thought he had been clever by saying everything has to be on the table, and somehow he thought this was a good strategic move. But all it did was play into Putin's hands, who's been trying to pitch this as the motherland against NATO and NATO being the aggressor. And so that plays right into Putin's narrative that he tries to feed to his home front. Didn't help. And then, you know, then of course, you know, Putin, you know, kind of alluded to the nuclear issue in terms of that would demand a nuclear response. Now, I don't think he's serious. He's not an irrational actor. And he knows that's a kind of a non-starter. All he wants is to stay in power. And I think, you know, for the same reason that Xi is always a little bit cautious over tipping too far to one side, is that he also doesn't want to, you know, envelop or embrace chaos, right? Mm-hmm. So you never know where that's going to shake out. So I think it'll be fine, but it was a strange move on Macron's part. And I think NATO, you know, the Allied command and everybody else trying to figure out what the hell was he smoking, or, you know, did he not have his meds leveled out or what? It just didn't make any sense for him to do that.
It not only didn't make sense, I don't understand how, I just can't picture him clearing this and then getting up there and other people going, yes, that's a strategic, intelligent thing to say on a world's platform while not discussing it in a way and the repercussions of those words. That's this is what I see, and maybe I'm wrong and you can feel free to correct me. It feels like the majority of the individuals dealing with this this massive situation, this pushback with Russia, the egos that are at play here are so astronomically large, most of them don't fit in the goddamn room together. And so I'm concerned that there is this boasting, this we're just going to send them. We're strong people. We're going to send them anyway. We don't care what you say you're going to do because we don't really think you're going to hit the button. It's like we're poking at the lion through the cage with a stick, waiting for him to snap. And is it because they want him to react so that we can then turn around and start firing up that machine again?
No, I think it's with Macron. I think that was an outlier comment. Okay. He didn't clear that with anybody. And there was so much pushback that I think it's clear in Putin's mind too. Again, you know, he said what you would expect. You know, usually he uses Medvedev to, you know, rattle the nuclear saber. But you know, Putin this time around felt he'd say it. It was during a State of the Union address. And so I think there's an understanding, I think, that we need to find an off ramp here. And the problem is going to be that Putin's not going to give up Crimea, right?
No.
not without a fight. The only way that Ukraine gets the negotiating table in a strong position is if they're winning, or they're holding Putin to a very strong and painful stalemate. And right now, the Russian military has a, not a massive advantage, but a slight advantage. They're on the offensive, which again, in terms of this, is, you know, sort of like a World War I offensive. It doesn't mean much, but they're the only ones gaining ground. Mm-hmm. And they certainly feel as if they've got the upper hand, right? Because they see Western support, you know, not necessarily from EU or NATO, but certainly from the US wavering. And if the US doesn't provide significant assistance and resources, then Ukraine isn't going to win. And so if you look at it that way and think, okay, well, then what prompts Putin to sit down at the negotiating table? Well, it's only if he feels like he's, again, losing or really facing some potential instability at home because of the painful, you know, war of attrition. So they've got to figure this one out. You know, they're not going to be able to reclaim Crimea in the current configuration. So Zelensky's going to have to, I think, rethink this posturing that he had about we're going to reclaim all our territory. Nobody gave a shit in the West about Crimea being in the Russian hands, right? Didn't know, no. You know, Obama administration didn't do shit about that. And nobody waved their Ukrainian flags and said, we stand with Ukraine. And nobody cared that they had troops in Eastern Ukraine for some time now, until this invasion. So I think the logical thing is to figure out a pathway to get back to that. And then, you know, it's just the sad reality that we've gone through, you know, 2+ years of painful, you know, lives lost and, you know, resources used. And what did it get us? Well, I think it probably, pragmatically, it'll get us back to where we started before the invasion.
That's just a really sad reality when you think about the amount of governments that have been putting up like substantial amount of money that apparently doesn't exist for veterans, homeless, addicts, or anything else in their own nations, but somehow is magically being found by people like Trudeau and Biden. And I'm trying to understand and try to be optimistic around this idea, because it's a very clearly, and I think the majority of people who had any wherewithal that pay attention to anything, and I'm not talking about CNN and Fox, but maybe individuals who served prior or whatever their experience, it became very obvious it was going to be a proxy war. It became very obvious this was going to be, we're just going to funnel money through because we don't want to put boots on the ground because we know that's the line in the sand for nukes. And I'm not understanding how we can continue to pledge funds like our sad example of a dictator just recently did again, stating that we're going to dump more and more and more fucking funds into something that is a, like, we have people on the ground. Yeah. We have strategic Americans and Canadians in Ukraine training people, doing the job, while a lot of the Ukrainians I'm getting reports of are using sweatpants and sticks to practice movements. So what I'm trying to understand is, where's that money going? How are we honestly believing that it's going to the front line? And if it is going to the front line, why aren't we seeing it?
Yeah, well, we're not seeing it in part because we've been really slow. Right. And, you know, regardless of where anybody stands on whether they should even be providing support or not, from an operational perspective, which is what I'm talking about, they've mm-hmm. been really slow in providing the advanced systems, right? Whether it's HIMARS right. or, you know, whatever the long range missile systems that can have a real impact. So the problem is, and again, this is aside from the fact of whether you agree with the whole process or not, I'm just saying, right. That's why we're not seeing the progress, is because we've been so slow in getting out. They're not going to get the first, you know, drop of F-16s until I think June, right? And, you know, air superiority is massive in these terms. And so I think there would have been a way, you know, if we'd said, okay, yeah, we're doing this proxy thing, but we're going to do it all in. We either do it or you don't half-ass it. Right. Then it would have been a matter of getting those systems out to them sooner, so that they could really inflict the pain that you need, than to get Putin to either retreat or sit down and have a meaningful negotiation and settle this thing and end it, right? So we've kind of, the West in general, has kind of done this where we want to feel good about ourselves by helping, but we don't want to escalate the conflict. And so we're not going to, so we really haven't done anything other than extend the process And again, my concern is that we're walking into a situation where at the end of the day, people are going to say, what the fuck was that all about? Right. It's
Well,
a little
you
bit like
mean,
Afghanistan, 20 years in
like
Afghanistan.
Afghanistan?
Yeah. I mean, in the sense that, yeah. Now, what was that all about? We didn't, what do you mean? We didn't turn him into a democracy. So,
Oh, we just gave them fruit boots, a bunch of Blackhawks, and have them roll down Kabul,
yeah.
taking girls out of school again. That feels like a good 20 years waste of my goddamn time and friends' lives. But
Yes.
hey, who am I to say
So,
anything,
I
right?
know.
Well, that brings me to the Afghan pullout.
Part of the problem is explaining to the public, whether it's the French public or the Brits or the Canadians or the US, you know, having an administration that says, this is why we're doing this. This is what we're spending. This is what we're spending it on. This is how we know it's going where it's supposed to go. You know, the administrations have a responsibility to be, you know, within reason, as transparent as possible. And that would probably help tamp down some of this, you know, I mean, look, people wore the Iraq and Afghanistan pain for a long time. You know, we're 2 years into Ukraine and everybody's like, what the fuck are we doing? Right.
We're
So,
fatigued already.
yeah, we're fatigued already. So I don't know. But I do think, I think, you know, Putin was wrong on a lot of counts. He was wrong in a lot of ways. You imagine this was going to splinter NATO. NATO's actually grown. He was wrong in terms of evaluating his own military's capabilities and command and control and all sorts of problems there. But I think what he got right was probably the impatience, right, of the West and the fact that we lose interest, you know, relatively quickly. So I feel, you know, I suspect his calculation is he can outweigh us, and in particular the US.
Well, let's be completely honest. Why wouldn't he believe that? Look at Afghanistan. Look at Iraq. Look at all of these places we pledged to go into and constantly, we're going to give democracy. We're going to give freedoms. We're going to give and act as if these cultures want that behavior. You
Right.
can't, you cannot win against people. I mean, it's the reason why it's like the death of the empires in the Middle East. Like, we understand there's a reason why I fought against people with Soviet weapons. They will outlast us. We know that. We, of course, Russia is going to have this belief system. They've seen it. We have so many examples in Putin's time that can point to they will fatigue. The people are so hyper distracted and strategically placed so that they just don't have the capacity.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's, and so he's made that calculation, and that's really at the end of the day, I think what he's banking on. So we'll see. Look, I suspect the U.S. will figure. Man, I think they're already knee deep in it. They're figuring out a way to get you know, munitions over there and just bypass the dysfunctional nature of Congress anyway. I mean, they're dysfunctional on many levels, right? I mean, again, they're arguing over this bill, but half of them don't even know why they're arguing it over, you know, over it. And you know, it's not enough to just say we should take all that money and spend it at home, right? You need to be able to multitask. So there will be occasions when you need to spend money on issues overseas that don't impact. But they should also be functioning so that they say we're going to spend, you know, they're going to spend money on the homeless situation, on vets, on the things that meant on infrastructure here, right? Build a fucking bridge, do something,
Or a
and
wall by the looks of it.
multitask, and also worry about those occasions that take place overseas where you really legitimately need to say, okay, do we have a role here? Do we need to play a role here? Is there some reason why we're here, and what is it? And then we have to explain it to the American public, or to, again, whatever nation we're talking about. So I don't know, but Washington, D.C., look, we don't send our best and brightest. You know, we've got some really good ones. Don't get me wrong. There's some very good, you know, politicians, and I know a handful of them that are based in Idaho. God bless Idaho. We tend to have really good politicians. Idaho's got a great system too. It's legislature. It's, you know, the state house. It's part time. They only, you know, they're in session for 3 months and they all go back to their ranches or to their businesses, do whatever they do. They come in, they've never run a deficit, right? Never. There's no such thing as deficit spending in this state. The governor doesn't have a mansion, lives in his house, walks down the street. You walk by, go, hey, Brad, what's going on, man? And, you know, it's the way that you feel government should be, right? It's, you know, so anyway, but on average, you could argue some of the folks that the country sends to Washington, D.C. may not be our best and brightest.
It just feels like they're delusional, completely out of touch, and not at all integrated into their societies, populations, and communities. And that's why I like your government. And I'm surprised you even say where you live and which state, to be honest with you. But I do love that you talk about it in that way, because I think if more people realized there was a possibility to be able to go back to that, then people wouldn't be so separated. The gaps of what Americans and Canadians and the rest of the world need could actually be discussed. But there seems to be this growing rules for what is it, rules for we and not for thee, or rules for thee and not for we, you know, that whole saying. You know, you got the Klaus Schwab,
we, thee and me, thy and them. I know what you mean, though. I remember the saying.
It's all right. It's two individuals over here that are just trying to get by on this conversation here, Mike. So I find it fascinating, though, the way that it works, because it does feel like every year that goes by in all of these different states and in these different countries, there is this growing separation. And that, to me, is how I feel like these decisions are being made on top of these bills that are so astronomically large. They do things strategically to slip them in where you're not consciously aware of what's going in. And then they have the audacity to allow people to vote on things they know they haven't read.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, we have to pass the bill to know what's in it. You know, you think like how does the American public put up with some bullshit statement like that, right? Say right. No. And you know, the other funny, not funny, but odd little mystery about Washington, D.C. is most of those bills are written by, you know, kids in their mid-20s, right? Who were out voting the night before, and, you know, they're drafting bills because, you know, it's not like your senator and your congressman are doing that work. So you get these junior sprogs that are out there writing bills of importance to the nation. It's an interesting situation. You take the self-interest out of it, get term limits, have some meaningful campaign finance reform. And I think we'd see a bit of a sea change. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think you gotta give it a try. And there's nothing wrong with term limits. There's nothing wrong with saying a congressman can serve 2 4-year terms. Right now they're 2-year terms, which means they're in a perpetual money raising cycle. And senators could have 2 6-year terms. So that's it. And then you go back and you do whatever you were doing for a living. But take some of that self-interest. There's no reason why someone should finish up as a politician after 46 years and be very wealthy
when they didn't $100 million in the bank.
Yeah. Doesn't make any sense to me. Why do we put up with it? But anyway, down that rabbit hole, didn't I?
No, I love those rabbit holes. These are the holes I like to live in, Mike. Right. So let's pull into some more. Ready?
Okay.
Canada. This is one of my favorite ones. And let me tell you why. I live here. Wow. We've got a lot of wild things happening up here. And I am concerned because the CCP have been here. They were here in 2020. The militaries were training in Connaught Range and on the outside of Canada. We saw them marching. No one can tell me otherwise. Salt Spring Island held them there. And we do have these people coming in to this country. I live in what I call, most people aren't going to love this one, Vancouver. And it's because we put extra taxes in because people come and drop their kids and their money in these really wealthy mansions and give them Lambos to drive down Granville at 180 kilometers miles an hour. So what I'm trying to understand here is, why is it that America's hat so on fire? The CCP have knowingly, while CSIS has reported, been inside of our government for a very long time, making heavy decisions while buying up all the property. So why is it you're laughing because you know I'm so goddamn right, and that's what scares the hell out of you. So why is it that we are so blindly, openly, and honestly inviting in to train, to educate in our governments, in our school systems, and everywhere else around us? Why are we allowing the CCP to do what they're doing? And they are coming in droves through America all the way into the United States, and they're all fighting age males. So what the hell is she planning, and why are the CCP so allowed to walk amongst this country in Canada while having CCP offices like police stations and then taking them and sending them back to China? What is going on, Mike?
Yeah, that was a lot there. That was a lot there. Yeah.
Hey, listen, I do some research, bud.
You're a very aggrieved individual. So it's true. Look, I mean, we had more across the southern border the last quarter of this past year of 2023, I think, compared to the last quarter of 2022, I think the increase in number of single male Chinese individuals crossing the border jumped by, 80%, 85%. It was a significant increase. And that's just for one quarter. So yeah, I mean, look, there's an awful lot there. We've been very slow over the years. I've said this, I don't know how many times, we've been very slow over the years in calling out the Chinese regime, not the Chinese people, not going after the history and culture. Fantastic. Right. It's, I'm talking about Xi and his regime. And he's cemented power like nobody since Mao, basically. And we've been very slow in calling them out for a lot of things, including theft of intelligence, theft of economic information, of intellectual property, of research and development. And they've been doing that for decades, right? You go back, this is not something new, right? They've been hoovering up information from the US and Canada and UK and all over. They're equal opportunity for generations. And that's how they bypassed a lot of the heavy lift of research and development and got to, you know, the world's second largest economy, and they believe they should be on the top of the heap. So they'll continue doing that. And occasionally, you know, Obama, you know, stood there with Xi and said, well, we've, you know, agreed to not engage in cyber shenanigans, and what a load of bullshit. So then the Xi regime just doubled down and spent more time doing it. Look, we really didn't have a dialogue about Chinese theft of intellectual property and what that means, the damage that it does to the U.S. and allies. We didn't really have that conversation until the previous administration. Now, you know, like him or not like him, you know, with Trump, you know, he did talk about China, obviously, all the time. And there was an effort to, and just the fact that you're shining a spotlight on the problem, it makes it better, right? It at least it makes companies, corporations, and others aware of, wait a minute, yeah, I guess there is a problem here. So we need to focus. And I know for a fact that that was happening because we run an intelligence and security business. And we started hearing a lot more from companies going, well, how do I protect myself if we're doing business over there? And that increased over the past handful of years. But we've been very slow in recognizing the threat and in dealing with it. And they gather information in all sorts of ways, you know, sending students over here to attend undergrad and graduate school, and then they end up getting a job at Raytheon or wherever, attending conferences and academic, you know, events where we're just handing out information, recruiting Chinese Americans, as an example, to provide intel, you know, if they're working for Dow or whomever. You know, give us, some of the, you know, information that you have access to. And they kind of play off of that, you know, Chinese descent and sort of reaching back to the homeland. There's a myriad of ways that they're, and then cyber shenanigans, there's a myriad of ways that they're gathering their information. That to me is the most egregious part. There's the other issues. There's their aggressiveness in particularly in the South China Sea and, you know,
next one.
And elsewhere, yeah. And there's Taiwan. There's, you know, the massive growth that they put into their military, particularly their Navy. There's the infiltration of our telecom systems, you know, selling low-cost gear to regional telecoms providers. And these guys are like, sure, I'll take this gear. It's cheaper. And then the next thing you know, they're running their entire regional telecoms business off of, you know, Chinese gear. And, you know, then suddenly everyone's surprised when they realize that, well, wait a minute, you know, one of the reasons they might have been doing this is because they can, you know, it's got dual purpose, right?
Are people not like, are the Chinese at this point banking on the Western world drive for financial relief, this idea that we can do things cheaper and easier because they've quite literally changed the way the psyche works in terms of as long as it's cheap enough, then it's right for us.
Yeah. I think part of it is the lure of the Chinese market, right? That's been the holy grail for a long time for a lot of companies. Is, you know, we want to be able to sell into the Chinese market, so you want to engage and develop relationships and do business, and oftentimes that means, you know, transactions are going both ways. Some of it is just, you know, the certainly on the telecom side, look, you know, finally, you know, the FBI, which spends a lot of time on Chinese counterintelligence issues, you know, they did some very good investigating and, you know, realizing that, look, there is no reason for these companies, supposed private companies, but they're state sponsored companies over China, to be selling equipment at such a low cost. There's no profit motive for them. So what are they doing? No, well, you know, in part, it's access to, you know, to towers, you know, and whether those towers are located near military facilities or whatever it may be. And part of it is just, it's just getting up the fact that we now have the ability to access and control or disrupt, right, or telecoms systems in the event that there's a major conflict, right? It's the same reason why they're testing and probing our infrastructure all the time in cyberspace, is because they want a playbook for should there ever be a major conflict. How do we take down the basic systems? Stop your transportation, stop your flow of fuel and food, disrupt power grids, disrupt water treatment facilities. So there's a lot of reasons why they do that. But yeah, look, again, I'm not a big fan of decoupling. You know, I think that's stupid because we're all connected and that, yep, you know, horse has left the barn. But we do need to be much more pragmatic and smart about how we do business with China. And we got to stop, you know, believing somehow that if we just, you know, give up a little something that somehow we're going to have access to this massive market and, you know, things are going to be good. That's not how they work. They don't have a rule of law over there. And again, not denigrating Chinese people. I'm just saying what the regime is all about.
Yeah, it's not about the people. Like, I think the thing that a lot of people don't understand about China is that if you are a privately owned company, you're not fully private. You're not private. They own the controlling of every single business. They have even 1% more than you to make sure that they have the controlling interest in a lot of these industries. And that could be small or large. It doesn't really matter, to be honest. They have the controlling interest. And if you mess around with these factories and you mess around with these people and you don't pay something, it's not the company that has the issue. That person then disappears. And I've seen it personally. Yeah. And I will tell you a story later about that, Mike. And so I find it fascinating. It is true.
And there's it's not like ByteDance or Huawei or any of them have the ability to say no to the regime. No. Right. If they come to them and say, we want whatever the information is that they have as a result of doing business in the West, they will provide that information. Right. Mm-hmm. And then they do a variety of other smart things. Look, they have a very strategic view on things. If you just look at mining, take mining, for example.
Oh, yeah.
And you think about the way that one of the things that they do. Look, let's pick a good one. Phosphate. You can't have large scale agriculture without phosphate. And I know people are always like, who wants big farms anyway? Well, of course you want big farms because you want to feed the world, right? Because that's also important. So without phosphate, you can't make fertilizer, you know. And so it's an important thing. It should be a critical mineral here in the U.S. It's not. And then the main phosphate producers, basically, what? China, Russia, Morocco. Now, China, in addition to, working very hard to push their own phosphate industry, they look at and they've realized in the U.S. they can do certain things. They can, through cutouts, through not going in there and saying we're the Chinese government, but working through environmental groups, working through local or community organizations, working with city councils or town councils, they can influence local and state policies against mining, right? And so in a place like Florida, where, you know, the phosphate business, okay, it's pretty much, you know, if we're not making phosphate, we've got to rely on China and Russia and Morocco for this. So they go in and they'll influence, you know, using cutouts, using, you know, these various, and then eventually it looks like you've got some community grassroots organization saying, we don't want phosphate mining in our, you know, our county. Yeah. And so the Chinese have been very smart in understanding if we push that, right, we can have a really serious impact on the U.S.'s ability to engage in business that we are definitely engaging in. You know, it's the same with, you know, other critical elements, right? And, you know, we talk about electric batteries, right, because we all want that green future. And somehow we're going to get away from fossil fuels. And
well, look at Canada and look at Alberta and look at the conversation coming from the CCP right through the Canadian government about we need to be green by 2030 or we're going to turn, you know, we're going to have no, you know what, Mike, we're not going to make any more fossil fuel vehicles. Yeah, because that's reality. Like, are you delusional? Are you fucking delusional, Canada?
Yeah. Well, I mean, meanwhile, China's opening, you know, two new coal plants a week. And, you know, it's just, And also, if anybody saw what a lithium mine looks like, a cobalt mine, and how damaging that is to the earth,
and the
they
people
might
that
be
work
quite
there.
smart, you know, just doing all these. I guess again, you may not like it, but the Canadians, the U.S., they tend to do mining in a much more environmentally friendly. It's ugly, but it's more environmentally friendly than what you're going to get elsewhere. Certainly run by, you know, some Chinese, you know, state-sponsored mining company in Africa. So,
you mean it, we're not going to put babies on our backs and go bare feet?
I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just, you know, because that's getting back to nature. But, you know, if you can put that baby to work, why wouldn't you?
Fucking twice, Mike. Oh,
yeah. You can't
oh,
really, you can't mine much. That's the only problem. You got to, you know, it takes about 100 babies to do one man's work. So, you know, it's a big operation.
You're so living up to everything I hope this would be.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
No, don't ever be. No, I'm right here for it. But I ask this in general sincerity because there is a, I am in a country where we are seeing very similarly to other countries like China, Russia, North Korea. We are seeing things happen with the CRTC. We are seeing things like Bill C-11. We are seeing new hate bills be put in. If I call somebody their actual birth name instead of they and them, I can be charged with a hate crime and held in for life in prison, Michael. So why is it that we are allowing this? Have we just poisoned the well? Is it that Trudeau is truly captured? Because I have a hard time believing that CSIS is fully captured when they dropped that document that just absolutely blew apart what was happening in Canada. And yet nobody said boo. It was totally, it's just delusional. That's not reality. Most people don't know what CSIS is unless they show up at your door. And they don't really, and they do it kindly. Like, let me side tangent, Mike. Have you seen the video of CSIS in black masks showing up at the Canadian's door who said that he wants to see Trudeau hanged? Have you seen that interaction?
No, I have not seen that.
Let me just give you a quick overview of how hilarious this was and gives you an illustration of Canada. CSIS comes to the door and they go, and he films it. And this is, I'm going to try to do the Canadian accent that I've so desperately lost. And it looks like this. And it goes, how can I help you guys? And they go, well, you know, bud, we've been looking on Twitter and been seeing that you're calling for the prime minister to be hanged. And he goes, yep, sure have there, bud. And they go, well, you know, we're from CSIS and we're here to let you know that we need you to tone it down. And he goes, well, I'm not going to, bud. So you're going to have to show up at my door. Well, I guess, sir, we're just going to be here a lot. And he goes, well, my wife's Tammy. She makes great coffee. If you want to come in and have a conversation with us, you're more than welcome to there. And the whole point of that is when CSIS starts showing up at your door, do not tell me that is any different than the CCP showing up at the people's individual homes. The only difference is they're not dragging you out by your throat and taking you to a gulag that doesn't exist in a concentration camp that apparently doesn't actively happen, which we know they do. So my point in saying that is there is behaviors happening that CSIS has reported and yet still been weaponized. And so I'm trying to understand, what is it? What is happening here? Why is it that laws and rules are being put in place and supposed to be one of the freest countries in the world, and yet nobody is screaming at the top of their lungs, except for the handful of few people, including Peterson and the others, going down to America, talking on large platforms, because none of our content gets shared anymore due to the Iron Curtain that now exists in this country.
Yeah. I think what's happening is a small, extremely vocal minority has bullied most people into just silence. It's certainly the case in the U.S. It's just not, and you can see it with corporate behavior in terms of the things that they do. You can see it in terms of how people interact. There's this sense of you know what, I'm just trying to put food on the table. I'm trying to take care of my family. I don't want the trouble. I don't want the problem. Right. And so this vocal minority of people who, you know, enjoy, you know, this power grab, they're able to push whatever agenda they want, because most people are just trying to get by. Right. And so they don't want to be shut down, and they see, you know, that's probably what will be happening, you know, if they push back. So it's easier not to push back for most people, right?
Is because that not like the definition of a communist state here, Mike? Where
that? Well, sure, yeah. That's a problem. Is because you know everybody just you know eventually goes along to get along, and the next thing you know you think to yourself, well, how'd that happen? You know, well, look, I mean, Portland, Oregon's a good example, right? They're now starting to push back against this, you know, free drugs and drug paraphernalia for everybody because the city turned to shit. And but for a while they were like, yeah, this is the way to go. We don't want to punish anybody. Well, yeah, you want to have justice, and you want to have fairness in your justice system and everything. But there should be consequences for bad behavior, and you know there should be. And the consequence in this case, when there wasn't consequence of bad behavior, was you turned your city, what used to be beautiful, into this shithole, and now the very progressive, you know, residents are starting to push back and say, yeah, maybe we actually do need consequences for criminal behavior. Then how about that as an idea? So I think you have to, it's like an alcoholic. I think you have to, they say you have to hit rock bottom, the very bottom, not just part of the bottom, but you have to hit the very bottom before you start changing your mind. And I think
wanna, though.
Yeah, we're starting to see that a little bit here, though. I think we're starting to see it in some ways where people are thinking, so we'll see. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic.
No, I like the optimism. Look, most of the time you look at these situations involving the CCP, and I'm not saying the Chinese, that's why I'm saying the CCP, because I believe the Chinese people here are some of the, what I see in Vancouver, at least during the protests, I'm sure you were consciously aware of the trucker protests going on up here. Yeah. I'm really proud of talking about that because there are a lot of Canadians and I come from truck drivers. So I'm very proud that these people stood up and were able to do so. But you also do see the Chinese dissidents that came from China standing there with masks going, you guys need to wake the fuck up because you don't quite understand what's happening right now under your face, under this guise of DEI and supporting others and allowing whatever we want to happen in this country. I'm genuinely concerned. And I know the people who have left China who have come here are also really concerned about it. That being said, I do appreciate the optimism because if somebody doesn't give me some optimism in this country, I don't know how much more I can take.
Exactly right. Yeah, you think now then what? Yeah, you gotta have some feeling, and I think it's I think Canada is the same. I think pretty resilient nations, you know, and you know you get this upheaval and you know you get a cycle of kind of moronic and stupid ideas, and whether it's defund the police. And again, I think people are coming back around from that idea because you know why? And when you take police off the streets or you stop funding them and you stop training them, they wanted better policing. Well, you know how you get better policing is you spend more money on the training. So the training is better and more consistent. And these dipshits, you know, said, no, we got to get rid of police and just have social community workers. Well, good luck having a social community worker rock up on a violent domestic situation. And the next thing you know, everybody's getting capped, and you think, wait, what about him? Anyway, it's so you get these cycles where you get these stupid ideas, and you get this small group of people who shout louder than anyone else in the room, and everybody else gets tired of being yelled at, and for a while they just acquiesce, and then eventually things get so bad that even the idiots think, yeah, maybe we got to change that. I mean, we got a lot of people moving out of California. Now, the problem is a lot of them move out of California because a place, you know, at least some of the urban centers, you know, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco for sure, you know, got shitty. So they move out, they come to a place like Idaho. Now, the problem is a lot of them, you know, they're not smart enough to understand that they left a place because they were all voting in a certain way. Now they come here and they want to vote the same way.
Right.
It's like a swarm of locusts coming across the country, fucking up every city. So I think we just have to. We have to hope that they get a little smarter.
I've heard that too. Every time I go, like I'm going down to Texas again next week. And I've heard that every time I go into these states, I go to Texas, I go to these places and they're like, they're just fucking everywhere. They're ruining everything.
They're everywhere.
Shift the perspective? But speaking of that and stupid ideas and really ignorant perspectives, how many planes do you think we need to see fall out of the sky before we decide that maybe having DEI in the air industry is probably not a good idea?
Yeah, that's a surprise. United kind of led the way on that one. The head of United Airlines didn't seem to think there was anything wrong with going all in on that idea. Now, I think, you know, once again, if he hadn't been so self-righteous and he'd gone and sat down with his marketing team and said, well, how should I present this? This is my idea. This is what I believe. Okay. how should I present it? Then maybe a smarter communications group and marketing team would have said, okay, here's how we need to package up your desire to say this, right?
Right.
But they don't do that. They all want to get out there and they all want to wave the banner of self-righteousness and mm-hmm. show, you know, how good they are. And they just, I don't know where that part of it goes, but I don't, you know, I think like one of my brothers was a senior pilot at one of the major airlines and he watched kind of the, you know, the way that it went with training. And I think they'll hold the line because it's one of those public safety issues that they can't really afford to get sideways with. It's one thing to say you're going to put, you know, a DEI component in there and you're really going to live by it and you're not going to focus necessarily on competency. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think the airline industry is quite that stupid. So I think they'll back off to some degree. But yeah, how about we just all get back to, you know, the most competent person gets the job. But then what happens is the vocal minority screams and goes, well, that's racist, or that's, you know, that's prejudice, or that's, you can't do that. You can't say the most competent person should get the job. And then that sounds pretty racist if you're automatically saying that, you know, you're disqualifying certain candidates. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that candidate, the most competent person, could be anybody.
Right.
From out there, right? So, but just give me the most competent person. And I don't care who, what they look like or what they believe. Everybody wants to be self-righteous. It's a very powerful motivation.
But forgive me if I'm wrong here. I'm pretty sure a lot of pilots, there's protocols, medications you can't be on, things you can't be on. But I'm, check me if I'm wrong here, but last time I checked, this DEI world of ours that we're swimming in and acting as if it's a completely acceptable thing for them to be flying airplanes often involves heavy medications, psychological disorders, and things that you cannot be taking as a pilot.
Yeah. That's why I think that the drug testing, the psychological testing that goes on, I don't see them adjusting that. Okay. Right. I can see it happening in a lot of sectors, but I'm pretty sure based on what I know about the airline industry that they're going to hold the line, no matter what the United Airlines CEO says or thinks. Because there's no quicker way to tank an airline than to lose a plane or two.
Or two.
So yeah, hopefully, knock on wood, that's not going to be the case. But it is. It's a component everywhere. Look, UNRWA, or not UNRWA, the United Nations, they're contracting. Everything that they do at the UN has a component now that you have to meet that's DEI-based, right? And that includes mind clearing. And, you know, I talked about a story the other day that, you know, where, you know, they put out a proposal for mind clearing that talked about, you know, how are you going to meet the DEI requirements to ensure that it's an inclusive program. And I'm thinking, you know, that unexploded ordnance doesn't give a shit what you look like, doesn't give a shit what you think or how you identify yourself. It's going to fuck you up with equally. Right?
Hi, Mr. Mine. My name is she, her, and I'm going to be here to, I'm going to be here to diffuse you today. This is a safe space. I want you to know that when I prod you, it's from love and only from a safe spot. I don't want you to feel triggered in any way. So please don't explode in my face.
Yeah.
Boom.
Hopefully don't feel triggered.
Doing here?
I don't know, but it's an example of just how bizarre and far it can go, but that's the UN, and that's any government organization, that's any nonprofit, that's the World Bank. Everything's got now this tick the box because there's a cottage industry, right? There's people making money. They get these jobs so that they can monitor the DEI compliance and berate other people to tell them how wrong they are and how they they built their careers on white privilege or whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah.
You know, so there's an industry that makes money off of this. And you could argue that it's a pack of grifters who see, you know, that there's an opportunity here for them.
1,000%.
Yeah. So
People don't have to like it. Like they don't have to like it.
Maybe I'm not being sensitive enough. I don't know. Hey, you know what I do have to do? You know what? And I hate to do this.
What?
But I'm going to have to leave so that I can go record the afternoon bulletin for the president's daily brief.
Okay. I'm going to let you leave, but only on one stipulation. You're like Kelsey, I'll just shut the screen off. I don't really care. Here's the stipulation. I have a lot of questions. I need you to come back on. I'd like you to come in person because we did not get into Ramadan that is about to kick off in a few days. And that's going to massively affect what happens in Israel with Hamas and what's being called for. And absolutely. I think that there is a lot of conversations around the Sudan, the waterways, the Afghan pullout, Hamas, Israel, Trump, how he just got allowed to stay on the ballot. Listen, Mike, I'm telling you,
there's a lot of shit there. I would love to come up to Vancouver. And hang out. Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, I'll shoot you a message after this, my friend. But anyway, Mike, not that you need it, but where the hell can people listen to the Presidential Daily Brief? How can they support you? How can they hire you at Portman Square Group for the leading security intelligence?
Hopefully they don't have problems where they need to hire us. Portman Square Group, it's an intelligence and strategic services or risk mitigation security services firm. But I appreciate you mentioning that. It's a great company. We've been very fortunate in hiring some wonderful people. But the President's Daily Brief, hey, it's available. Morning edition, the afternoon bulletin on any podcast platform you've got, Spotify, Amazon, all the usual Apple. So we're out there. Tune in. We'd love to have you sign on for sure. And we'll be putting out soon. Here's a little bit of breaking news. The premium subscribers opportunity, so you don't have to listen to those pesky ads.
That's all right. I'm here for it. Mike, I cannot thank you enough for your time. And I know my listeners are going to be stoked beyond all get out, but I am looking forward to having you back up here. We'll schedule that afterwards. You stick with me. Everyone else, we'll see y'all next week.